The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello. She was, according to one source, a fine lady who writes verses, sings, dances, and can say and do whatever she pleases without the imputation of anything that could injure her character, for she is so well known to have no passion but self-love, or folly but affectation, that now, upon any occasion, they only cry, "It is her way," and "That is so like her," without farther reflection. She quotes a wonderfully just passage from Milton, calls a licentious speech from Dryden's State of Innocence an odious thing, and says a thousand good things at random, but so strangely mixed that you would be apt to say all her wit is mere good luck, and not the effect of reason and judgment. End quote. A lively, spirited woman who also happened to write novels and plays and who put out several volumes of a journal herself, the first woman in England to do so. A publisher, an actor, a translator, a figure about town, and yet her background was mysterious then and even more mysterious now. And today, her name is hardly known at all. Eliza Haywood, the irrepressible best-selling author of the early 18th century, attacked by some of the leading literary figures of her day, but who also returned fire, too. Today, on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. A fun one today as we steam toward the holidays. Our appetizer is going to be one of the great letters in all of literature. We might do this as a series. We will see. Great letters of literature. In this one, poet John Keats writes to his brothers, and he coins a phrase, which is really a concept as well as just a phrase. Coins a concept, then. Mints a concept. Negative capability. What is that all about? And what is the rest of the letter, including the painting he described? We will hear it and discuss it. And then we'll head back even further in time to the early to mid 18th century for a look at a forgotten woman of literature, Eliza Haywood, an irrepressible publishing phenom. She took some shots. Did you hear the one in the introduction? Her wit was mere good luck, it seemed. What sort of a thing is that to say about a best-selling author? And Alexander Pope wrote her up in his famous scree, the Dunciad. Scree? Did I say scree? That is the gravel and dirt at the base of a hill. I've walked through scree. That's not what word am I looking at? Screed. That's the word. His famous screed. The Dunciad. Some might object to that characterization as a screed. Some might say, no, the Dunciad isn't a screed. It's not tiresome. It's a classic mock heroic epic, Jack. Some might say that. I will reserve my judgment until we do our Alexander Pope episode. Decision pending. Maybe we will do an episode on Pope in 2022, but for now, let's just say that he was very influential in his day, very well respected. And if he was attacking a best-selling woman novelist, it would be very public. A bit flattering to have made his radar, I suppose, but mostly what he wrote was slanderous and hurtful. We'll see how Eliza Haywood handled it. This is part 6 of our series of Forgotten Women of Literature. You can find the previous 5 in our archives. There's some good episodes there in that series. Anna Duana, Amelia Lanier, etc. This one was suggested by our Patreon supporter, Linda S., who discovered Margot Livesey via our show, which warms my heart. And Linda was also excited to listen to our episodes on Oscar Wilde and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I hope those lived up to your expectations, Linda. She also enjoyed the Philip Roth episode with Mike Palindrome we had recently. Linda said, how about Elizabeth Haywood and Fantomina for the next Forgotten Women of Literature? And I said, yes, absolutely. Great choice. Thank you, Linda, for supporting the show and to all our patrons. You are the angels that give me strength and make this show possible. You can find that at patreon.com/literature if you are so inclined. But first, let's hear from John Keats. We'll do that after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Here is the letter. Are you trembling? I'm trembling a little to hold the paper. I don't have the actual letter. I have a printout of it, of course. Sunday, it begins. This was written, we know, on the 21st of December, 1817. Sunday, Hampstead. My dear brothers, let me explain. Keats was writing to George and Thomas, his brothers, both of them younger than him. He says, I must crave your pardon for not having written ere this. I saw Keene return to the public in Richard III, and finally he did it. Okay, we start with a description of some plays and some reviews that Keats had written and some other essays in the newspapers that Keats was passing along. I'll just skip over this, but let's dwell for a moment on the play he mentions at first and the actor. The play is, of course, by Shakespeare, which is important later in the letter. And Keene, the actor that he saw return to the public in Richard III, is Edmund Keene, considered one of the greatest actors of his day. Keene is famous for the story, which may or may not be true. It's a very good story, that he was on his deathbed and someone asked him how he was feeling, and he said, dying is easy, comedy is hard. Keats talks about some socializing he's done. This is what he's telling his brothers in the letter. And then he says he went to see the painting Death on the Pale Horse, which is by an American painter, Benjamin West. Keats says, quote, I spent Friday evening with Wells and went next morning to see Death on the Pale Horse. It is a wonderful picture when West's age is considered, but there is nothing to be intense upon. No woman one feels mad to kiss, no face swelling into reality. The excellence of every art is its intensity, capable of making all disagreeables evaporate from their being in close relationship with beauty and truth. Examine King Lear, and you will find this exemplified throughout. But in this picture, we have unpleasantness without any momentous depth of speculation excited in which to bury its repulsiveness. Death on the Pale Horse. What are we getting at there? It's a wonderful painting, according to Keats, that Keats nevertheless found lacking. You can look at this painting online to see what Keats was going after here, what he was looking at. It's based on the four horsemen of the apocalypse in the New Testament. It's quite large. It has death and war and famine and pestilence with a lot going on. It's one of those paintings with lots of horses and lions and people and things floating in the sky, and it's dramatic and moody and complicated. It came with an explanatory pamphlet. What did Keats object to? He was looking for truth and beauty, those moments that rise up out of art. A woman one feels mad to kiss, That's a stand-in. That's an example for him of what he means when he says something to be intense upon. His other example is a face swelling into reality. Something true, something near truth and beauty. Something that art gives you that's so close to truth and beauty that it takes your breath away. This painting, however, is just, I don't know, awe, overwhelming. Maybe it impresses. You say, that's pretty good for someone of his age, but it's not uplifting or inspiring. Impressing you with its logic and composition and execution, that's not what Keats wanted from art. He wanted art to get his heart racing. He didn't want his art to need explanatory pamphlets. Back to the letter. Quote, I dined with Hayden the Sunday after you left and had a very pleasant day. I dined too, for I've been out too much lately, with Horace Smith, and met his two brothers, with Hill and Kingston, and one Dubois. They only served to convince me how superior humor is to wit in respect to enjoyment. These men say things which make one start without making one feel. They are all alike. Their manners are alike. They all know fashionables. They have a mannerism in their eating and drinking, in their mere handling a decanter. They talked of Keane and his low company. Would I were with that company instead of yours, said I to myself. I know such like acquaintance will never do for me, and yet I am going to Reynolds on Wednesday. Brown and Dilke walked with me and back from the Christmas pantomime. I had not a dispute but a disquisition with Dilke on various subjects. Several things dovetailed in my mind, and at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. End quote. There it is. The epiphany is so striking. Keats spends dinner after dinner with boring people. They complain about low company, and he says, I'd rather be with the low company than with you guys, you boring people. These are people who make one, they say things without making one feel anything. Keats doesn't want to be impressed. He wants to live. He wants to feel life. It's like the painting, too, that he mentioned earlier in the letter. It's impressive, sure, it's grand, it's accomplished, it's well done, but it doesn't make you fall in love or feel like you're seeing something real or feel like the art can make you feel something. There are no passions aroused, not just sexual passion, although it could be that, too, but all the passions of being human and alive and the passions of art, capital A, when they are at their finest, near truth and beauty, being moved, being engaged. So, negative capability, it's there in literature. Shakespeare has it. Man capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without irritable reaching for fact and reason, living with that mystery without trying to explain it away. You might fall in love with this part or that part. It might awaken you. It might stir you. You don't need a pamphlet to tell you all about it. He gives another example, Coleridge. He says, quote, Coleridge, for instance, would let go by a fine isolated verisimilitude caught from the penetralium of mystery, from being incapable of remaining content with half knowledge. This, pursued through volumes, would perhaps take us no further than this. That with a great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration, or rather, obliterates all consideration. End quote. Now, what does Keats mean here? He might be talking about Kubla Khan. He might be talking about Christabel, two poems of Coleridge's that had both come out the year before. Both those were half-finished, Coleridge's fantastical visions, and Coleridge wrote apologies and explanations to the readers, over talking, looking to explain, theorizing, and getting in the way, letting it go by. It's the famous story. It reminds me of the famous story of Paul McCartney writing Hey Jude. And he has some filler words that he's planning to change. He sings a song to John, his creative genius partner, and he sings the phrase, "The movement you need is on your shoulder." And he says, "I'll change that part." And John says, "You won't, you know." I love these stories so much, of this creativity in action. And Paul says, "But it doesn't mean anything. The movement you need is on your shoulder. It just popped out. I'll change it." And John says, "I know what it means. That's the best line in the whole thing." That's what Byron was doing for Coleridge. In fact, Coleridge was saying, "Oh, geez, I wrote this poem, Kubla Khan. It was interrupted by that idiot from Porlock. What was I thinking?" And Byron said, "Who cares? This is amazing. You have to publish it." And Christabel, in which a young noblewoman in the woods encounters a kind of supernatural figure, a lesbian vampire of sorts, Coleridge writes that too, apologizes and says, "I didn't finish this either. It got too crazy. I couldn't finish it. It makes no sense. Here's how I might have finished it, but it's too crazy." He's willing to abandon it, let it go by, because he can't figure it out, explain it. Let it go by, as Keats says, something that he caught from his penetralium of mystery, which is, by that he means, the secret part of mystery, the unknown part of our mind or of our universe where magic happens. And Coleridge tapped into it twice, and then the scholar in him took over and said, "Nope, logically, rationally, this doesn't work." And Byron says, "Who cares? Publish it too. Publish both of those. We need them." Well, Keats says Shakespeare wouldn't have had a problem with it. Shakespeare had this enormously, this negative capability, this willingness to live with the mystery, the beauty, the terror, the truth, the contradictions, the illogicality. Live with that without needing to explain. Art is better for it. Let's take a quick break and come back with, dare I say it, the surprising look at Eliza Haywood, forgotten woman of literature, and her 18th century novel, Fantomina, or Love in a Maze. Most of Eliza Haywood's background and personal life are shrouded in mist. According to Wikipedia, her biographers only really agree on one thing. Let's hold off on that one thing. Keep that as a surprise. Keep our powder dry on that one. Instead, we can celebrate the ambiguity and uncertainty of what we know about her and the solidity of what emerges from those mists. Here's the ambiguity: where she was born, when she was born, whom she married, if she did, who fathered her children. Most of her friendships are speculated about, argued over. Basic biographical facts are hard to pin down, except for one, which we'll get to later. She was born in 1693, probably. She was a woman of ill repute, we think. Her name was originally Eliza Fowler, but we're not sure which of the Fowlers she was related to. And her last name became Haywood, but we're not sure exactly how, to whom she was married. She had an affair and a child with the poet Richard Savage, and a 20-year affair with William Hatchett, the pamphleteer, who also fathered a child with her, unless neither of those men did. We're not sure about that either. It's all speculation. Was she born in London or near Shropshire? Did she marry the Reverend Valentine Haywood or someone else? Was she widowed, or was her marriage simply unfortunate? In quotes. Or was she never married at all? Part of this is because the records were poor in those days. It also seems to be that she was a private person who asked those closest to her to keep details about her close to their vest. And we kind of know the reason why. She was constantly attacked in print by some of the greatest names of the 18th century: Alexander Pope, Jonathan Swift, Henry Fielding all took their shots. But why were they teeing off on such an anonymous nobody? It was because she was not an anonymous nobody. She was a one-woman cultural dynamo. She wrote, she acted, she published. She did all this for money, and it worked. She was hugely prolific. That's what's so great about what does emerge. She wrote and wrote and wrote. Every time you turn around, she's doing something different. Novels, appearing in plays, writing essays, manuals on social behavior, translations, periodicals. She started publishing them too. She seems to have been someone who could crank out whatever people were buying, adapting her style to whatever genre or type of publication was called for. When Addison and Steele put out their famous Spectator publication, she launched her own called the Female Spectator, becoming in the process the first woman to run an English periodical. Her list of publications is lengthy, more than 70, and she didn't hide behind a pseudonym, or at least not always. Eliza Haywood, the title pages declare. Actually, her first book doesn't declare that. It just trumpets the contents. Love in Excess, or The Fatal Inquiry, a novel, it says. The biggest word on that title page is the word novel. Then it has a quote. In vain from fate we fly, for first or last, as all must die. So 'tis as much decreed above, that first or last, we all must love. Price, 1 shilling. Amatory fiction, it was called, and she was not the only woman writing it. She was one of the most prolific, but there were others too. They were envied for their sales and attacked as vacuous, attacked by men in their day, attacked by men ever since, dismissed and belittled. Meanwhile, readers paid their shillings and took their chances. Love in Excess deals with a fallen woman. A man reassures a woman, quote, there are times in which the wisest have not power over their own actions, end quote. More novels followed, tales of Venetian aristocrats and narrow escapes. A woman falls in love with a man. She learns he's engaged to another woman, so she heads for a convent. One thing happens after another. On her way there, she's attacked and courted and betrayed and revered in rapid succession. She ends up on a ship captured by pirates before it's wrecked in a storm. The heroine washes ashore on a plank and makes her way to Rome disguised as a man, only to be robbed and beaten and left for dead. A lady takes her home, falling in love with this woman in disguise, until it turns out that this lady is none other than the one who married the man that our heroine was originally in love with, the reason why she went to the convent in the first place. The wife is immensely jealous and tries to poison everyone. Then she tries to get the Pope to stop the burdening love. It's all wild and improbable and has the kind of telenovela feel to it. For Eliza Haywood, at this stage, there's no corner she couldn't write her way into and no corner she couldn't write her way out of. Coincidences and improbable events are part of the game. Those books were from 1720 to 1723. By 1724, the title pages were different. Her name was now proudly displayed. There was no need to say that it was a novel in all caps and huge letters. The reading public knew what they were getting, a work of fiction by Eliza Haywood. Instead, the title is Fantomina, or Love in a Maze, being a secret history of an amour between two persons of condition. The biggest word on the title page now is amour. And the verse this time isn't just about love. It's a double entendre about sex, the little death or orgasm, and the way that lovers battle one another. Fantomina is pretty awesome, actually. It takes the damsel in distress and turns that conceit upside down. Women can want men too. They can chase as well as be chased. The protagonist disguises herself 4 times to go and get the same man. This man, this dupe, doesn't recognize her, that it's the person he keeps meeting. Each time, the protagonist adopts a different persona of a different station in life, and she sees how the man treats her, and of course, we the readers see it too. First, She disguises herself as a prostitute. He attacks her. No does not mean no to a prostitute. Afterwards, she calls herself Fantomina to protect her reputation. He tries to pay her, and she refuses his money. Confused, he takes off for Bath. Fantomina now disguises herself as a maid and gets a job at the inn where he's staying, calling herself Celia. He has no idea this is someone he's already met twice, as her undisguised self in the beginning and as the disguised prostitute that he attacked, and now as the maid. Just go with it. This time she works her way into bed with him, letting him think he's seducing Celia, but secretly she's pulling the strings. He pays her after that. Eventually he gets tired of this maid, so he heads back home. On the way he meets a widow on the road, except it's not a widow. It's Fantomina slash Celia again, this time disguised as Mrs. Bloomer, the widow. He invites her into his carriage. He's struck by her grief. He tries to cheer her up, and once again, they have sex. All three encounters have resulted in sex. All three have had different power dynamics based on the character that Fantomina slash Celia slash Mrs. Bloomer have been dressed up as. But she's not done with him. When he tires of the widow, Mrs. Bloomer, she sends him a note signed Incognita, saying she's a secret admirer. She loves him and will refuse him nothing except for one thing, the sight of her face. So he meets her and once again has sex with her, agreeing to let her wear a mask. Finally, she gets pregnant. She names the man as the father. And in the end, Fantomina's mother makes her go and live in a monastery in France. A wild ride, Fantomina. Power dynamics, gender relations, disguises, trickery, love of a transactional sort, transactional sex of a sometimes loving sort, class implications, manipulation. It was hugely popular in its day, and then it was too hot to publish for a couple of hundred years. Scholars today find a lot to like. There's a lot to like in Eliza Haywood's story, too, both in her works and in her role as a woman author making it on her own, fighting. She took shots. We'll get to those in a moment. But she gave it back, too, and she seems to have known just how to get her revenge. Sell more books. I've told this story before, I think, on the podcast, but it's one of my favorites, so I'll tell it again. It was an interview I saw with John Grisham, the best-selling legal thriller writer. You know his books, The Firm, The Pelican Brief, all of those. His first book, maybe his couple of books, first couple of books were high art literary fiction. They were published, got some nice reviews, and sold almost nothing. And then he found his groove with legal thrillers, and suddenly he became enormously wealthy, a household name, the kind of guy who had Tom Cruise and Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington playing his characters on screen, not just in one lucky movie, but in a dozen or so big best-selling books. And the interviewer asked Mr. Grisham, do you ever regret writing these potboilers? Does a part of you wish you were winning prizes like a Philip Roth or a John Updike? And he said, oh, sure, it'd be nice to win more prizes, but I suspect those guys sometimes wish they sold as many books as I do. It's not an easy thing to do, to write a bestseller. It's not automatic. Very good writers can't always pull it off. Bestsellers can't always win prizes, and prize winners can't always write bestsellers. It's not just that they choose not to, people. You might think that, oh, John Updike, Philip Roth, guys like that can write whatever they want. No, it's not always that they choose not to write a bestseller. It's that they can't. It's harder than it looks, people. Which is why I celebrate Eliza Haywood and Fantomina and all her other books. Let's run through the titles to enjoy, celebrate amatory fiction in all its early 18th century glory and how prolific she is. Some of these works are translations. Some of these are sort of kind of plagiarized or heavily borrowed. Some are written afresh. Some are plays. Some are novellas. And some are even shorter. 1720, she wrote Love in Excess, which we talked about already. Letters from a Lady of Quality. 1721, The Fair Captive. 1722, the British recluse, the injured husband, 1723. This is when we start to get these double-barreled titles. Idalia, or the unfortunate mistress, a wife to be let. Lysalia, or the self-abandoned. The rash resolve, or the untimely discovery. I love that one. The rash resolve, or the untimely discovery. 1724 really heats up. We get a bunch that year. Poems on several occasions. A spy upon the conjurer. The masqueraders, or fatal curiosity. Next one. The fatal secret, or constancy in distress. Here's a good one. The surprise. Here's another one. The Aragonian queen, a secret history. The force of nature, or the lucky disappointment. Memoirs of the Baron de Brosse. La Belle Assemblée, which is a translation. And then in 1725, Fantomina, or Love in a Maze. The Lady's Philosopher's Stone also came out in 1725. That was another translation. There are dozens more. The Mersenne Lover, or The Unfortunate Heiresses. These double-barreled titles are so amazing. The Double Marriage, or The Fatal Release. Persecuted Virtue, or The Cruel Lover. Oh, I can't get enough. Each side of the semicolon is just as good as the other. The Perplexed Duchess, or Treachery Rewarded. When did we stop doubling up on our pleasure with these titles? We either have one good title, like Fatal Attraction, or we have two because one of them is boring. But to burn up two good titles in one, this is a writer who is giving the public what it wants, a putter-inner, not a taker-outer. Here's one. The Distressed Orphan, or Love in a Madhouse. How good is that? I would buy a book called The Distressed Orphan. I would also buy a book called Love in a Madhouse. You're giving me both at once? This sounds like a story I need to read. There are also political satires, travel books, all stuff that sold. Meanwhile, Eliza Haywood was acting too, starting in Dublin, where she appeared in an adaptation of Shakespeare called Timon of Athens, or The Man-Hater. tickets this way, ladies and gents. You maybe were bored last time you saw Shakespeare. Let's give you another part of the title to keep you... to keep you in your seat. My goodness, this is so much fun. She moved to London and kept working in the theater, writing some original plays, rewriting others, acting, and getting herself into hot water with political plays. She wrote a companion to the theater, giving plot summaries, literary criticism, advice. 12 years later, she followed that up with a second volume. Whenever she had some kind of setback, she proved she could just write and publish and adapt to whatever circumstances were advantageous. Meanwhile, her attackers started coming out. Alexander Pope portrayed her as licentious and vacuous in his Dunciad. She's for sale, he suggested. She'll write anything for money. My guess is that prize winners wish they sold as many books as me, says our guide for the day, Mr. Grisham. She sold so many books as Mrs. Haywood that Henry Fielding based a spoof character on her called Mrs. Novel. Mrs. Novel just responded with more novels and with a spoof of Richardson's Pamela. Fielding had spoofed that too, of course, with his book Shamela, which is not a bad title for a satire of Pamela, but I like Eliza Haywood's title too. Richardson's book was called Pamela, or Virtue Rewarded. Eliza Haywood's title was The Anti-Pamela, or Feigned Innocence Detected. Think about that for a moment, just based on those titles. You know what Richardson is doing, how seriously he's taken, how was and is for his moral teaching and his good sense and all that, Pamela, or virtue rewarded. Eliza Haywood says, no, no, this is the anti-Pamela, feigned innocence detected. Which sounds more real to you? Virtue rewarded or feigned innocence detected? Which sounds more like someone who knows London better? Which one sounds more like a novelist, frankly? I like that Eliza Haywood gave it back as well as she got, and she didn't stop. When the Female Spectator finally ran out of steam, she started up another journal. When political winds changed, she altered course too. When Latinate prose was standard for essay writing, she used it. When livelier prose made novels sell better, she used that too. When it turned out that novelists got paid once, with no ongoing royalties, as was the custom of her day, she wrote her work in multiple volumes, so she'd get more than one paycheck. When payments from her publisher didn't get her enough money, she started publishing the books herself. And when she wrote her Spectator, the Female Spectator, she followed the lead of Addison and Steele, which had, in their Spectator, they had multiple characters giving thoughts on various issues of the day. Hers was different, drawing upon the opinions and statements of four women. The Female Spectator, sort of the, that's one of the characters, one of the women, who was sort of the main editor of the thing, with three assistants who were, the three of them, giving the opinions of different women in different stations of life. A beautiful unmarried woman, a happily married woman, and a widow. Eliza Haywood wrote all four characters. She kept this up once a month for 2 years, 24 editions in all, including something like 60 stories of moral instruction and anecdotes about elopement and love affairs and illegitimate children and disguises. Always disguises. Women disguise themselves as men frequently in Eliza Haywood's world. And I think it's clear why. There's no better way to expose the treatment of women by men than to put a woman in a man's world and show how differently the same exact person is then treated. Shifting the expectations and revealing the inner thoughts of the person who is suddenly given access to what it's like to be on the other side. It's not the only way you can explore these ideas, but it's an effective way. It's convenient for a writer who's looking to explore those ideas. But that wasn't the only thing she wrote about. One series of issues of the Female Spectator was devoted to the study of Baconian empiricism and the natural world. Apparently, it fostered women's interest in owning a microscope. Is that so vacuous, Mr. Pope? Maybe he was the dunce in this particular case, at least. At any rate, I'll stick with the underdog, Eliza. I still haven't told you the one thing that biographers agree upon when it comes to her, the one fact we're getting there. But first, let's hear a little bit of her prose. Here's an example of her at her heart-pounding best. Here's a letter written by a character in Love in Excess, her first novel. This is a character named Melantha. She writes in this letter, quote, torture, distraction, hell, what will become of me? I will not survive the knowledge that you are mine no more. Yet this suspense is worse than all yet ever bore the name of horror. Let me not linger in it. If you have humanity, declare my doom at once. Be kind in cruelty, at least, and let one death conclude the thousand, thousand deaths which every minute of uncertainty brings with it. 2. The miserable, but still adoring, Melantha. P.S. I have ordered the messenger to bring an answer. If he comes without, depend I will murder him, and then myself. End quote. What a letter. Oh. And now let's pull some from Phantomina. Of course, this is sort of an obvious choice to read you something from this novel. Here we go. Quote, coming the next morning, this is the part where she has dressed up as Celia at the inn, and she's trying to seduce her man.
Quote,
coming the next morning to bring her chocolate, as he had ordered, he catched her by the pretty leg, which the shortness of her petticoat did not in the least oppose. Then, pulling her gently to him, asked her how long she had been at service, how many sweethearts she had, if she had ever been in love, and many other such questions, befitting one of the degree she appeared to be. All which she answered with such seeming innocence as more inflamed the amorous heart of him who talked to her. He compelled her to sit in his lap, and gazing on her blushing beauties, which, if possible, received an addition from her plain and rural dress, he soon lost the power of containing himself. His wild desires burst out in all his words and actions. He called her little angel, cherubim, swore he must enjoy her, though death were to be the consequence, devoured her lips, her breasts with greedy kisses, held to his burning bosom her half-yielding, half-reluctant body, nor suffered her to get loose till he had ravaged all and glutted each rapacious sense with the sweet beauties of the pretty Celia, for that was the name she bore in this second expedition. Generous as liberality itself to all who gave him joy this way, he gave her a handsome sum of gold, which she durst not now refuse for fear of creating some mistrust, and losing the heart she so lately had regained, therefore taking it with an humble curtsy and a well-counterfeited shoe of surprise and joy, cried, "Oh, law, sir, what must I do for all this?" He laughed at her simplicity, and kissing her again, though less fervently than he had done before, bade her not be out of the way when he came home at night. She promised she would not, and very obediently kept her word. End quote. You can hear what's in this for the readers and why Eliza Haywood was popular. You can also hear why we read Jane Austen today and can still read the earlier Fanny Burney, but why Fantomina is more of an appreciation we might have for its literary, historical, or thematic importance rather than its you-must-read-this quality. It was surpassed by later works. It's a bridge from sheer sensationalism to a more sophisticated look at human beings and their psychological underpinnings. And the style has evolved in later works. The style of Eliza Haywood has not held up all that well. As an intrepid biographer of hers wrote in 1913, Mrs. Haywood, as we have seen, looked to the booksellers for support when her husband disclaimed her. Of all the Amazons of prose fiction who, in a long struggle with neglect and disparagement, demonstrated the fitness of their sex to follow the novelist's calling, none was more persistent, more adaptable, or more closely identified with the development of the novel than she. Mrs. Benn and Mrs. Manley must be given credit as pioneers in fiction, but much of their best work was written for the stage. Eliza Haywood, on the other hand, added little to her reputation by her few dramatic performances. She achieved her successes first and last as a writer of romances and novels, and unlike Mrs. Aubyn and her other rivals, continued to maintain her position as a popular author over a considerable period of time. During the 36 years of her activity, the romances of Defoe and of Mrs. Jane Barker gave place to the novels of Richardson, Fielding, and Smollett. Yet the female veteran kept abreast of the changes in the taste of her public and even contributed slightly to produce them. Nor was her progress accomplished without numerous difficulties and discouragements. In spite of all, however, Mrs. Haywood remained devoted to her calling and was still scribbling when the great Dr. Johnson crowned the brows of Mrs. Charlotte Lennox to celebrate the publication of The Life of Harriet Stewart. After such recognition, a career in letters was open to women without reproach. Though unlaureled by any lexicographer, and despised by the virtuous Mrs. Lennox, Mrs. Haywood, nevertheless, had done yeoman service in preparing the way for modest Fanny Burney and quiet Jane Austen. Moreover, she was the only one of the old tribe of romancières who survived to join the new school of lady novelists, and in her tabloid fiction, rather than in the criminal biography
or the Voyage Imaginaire or the Periodical Essay may best be studied, the obscure but essential link between the voluminous extravagances of the Parthenissa and the hearty and less long-winded histories of Pamela and Clarissa. End quote. She was a bridge. And not just in the sense that one or two novels are middle ground, like a fossil that fills in an anthropological gap in the development of a species, a missing link, but her life bridged from one style to the next. And she was aware of this. Haywood herself, autobiography was one of the only genres she didn't try. So once again, her thoughts on herself in this respect are gleaned from her essays and a few letters that have survived. But a passage like this shines through. Quote, "It would be impossible to recount the numerous difficulties a woman has to struggle through in her approach to fame. If her writings are considerable enough to make any figure in the world, envy pursues her with unwearied diligence. And if, on the contrary, she only writes what is forgot as soon as read, contempt is all the reward. Her wish to please excites, and the cold breath of scorn chills the little genius she has, and which, perhaps, cherished by encouragement, might in time grow to a praiseworthy height." End quote. Eliza Haywood has faded back into the mists of time, and her works have too, for the most part. But she highlighted for us what it was like to be that young woman, perhaps a single mom of two, firing off opinions, cranking out words for money, living by her wit, even if the men around her viewed her wit as being correct or profound only by mere accident. I tend to think it was more than that. Genius is not always cherished by encouragement. Instead, envy pursues with unwearied diligence. These guys probably wish they sold as many copies as me. Sometimes. There's one fact biographers agree upon. They don't agree on where she was born or when, whom she was married to, if she was married, if she had two children she supported, or if this was slanderously invented by Pope. They don't know if she was the daughter of a store owner or the sister of a sir. But they agree on one thing, the exact date of her death. The world took note of that. She was born an anonymous nobody. But by the time she died, Eliza Haywood was somebody. Okay, there we go. A forgotten woman of literature, Eliza Haywood. My thanks to our listener and patron, Linda S., for suggesting that one. That's number 6 in the series, I think, if I'm counting correctly. The past episodes are in our archives. Anna Duana was good. Cayenne, who else? Constance Fenimore Wilson was one. Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. Amelia Lanier. I'm ticking these off. Add Eliza to their ranks. We are the History of Literature Pod. I don't know why I just said that. I said it that way. We are the History of Literature Podcast. I guess we are. We put this thing out anyway. We have more good episodes coming up. I told you there's one for cooking coming up. That's next time. Cooking and listening to the show with a couple of chatty friends talking about Shakespeare. Good for your family meal preparation, I hope. That's coming up on Monday with a new biography and biographer of Kurt Vonnegut. After that, I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.